We've been working on the idea or the thesis that God's words in this book have been addressed to us because we are made the way He made us. And it seems that the bottom line in His creation of us is that we are creatures of eternity. Once He creates a person, there is no end to that person. It's forever. But He made the external element, the body, out of the dust of the ground. And then He breathed the spirit into that body that gave it functional capacity. It's called a life-giving spirit. And that set us up for a new identity. Instead of being a body of dust, we are a living soul. And it seems to be that these words are the foundation for our understanding of a great deal of Scripture, because there are a multitude of contexts in the Bible that follow the pattern of body, soul, and spirit, or body, spirit, and soul, or soul, spirit, and whatever. All three of them not necessarily in any given order. And in the progressive revelation of God's Word, because it took 100 years for all of the New Testament to be written, and it took about 1,500 years for all of the Old Testament. Well, there wasn't a writing prophet after Malachi, and he was 450 years before Christ. So at least 1,100 years of writing prophets, starting with Moses, including Job, and that made up the Old Testament, which meant that generation by generation, the people who lived in the later generations had more understanding simply because there had been more information given. That's what they call progressive revelation. God tells you something here, and then He develops it here and develops it more here. It's kind of like Genesis 3:15, where He promises that the seed of the woman will crush the head of the serpent, but in the process He'll be wounded in the heel. And that's metaphorical language, but nonetheless it's a prediction of the Christ. Well, in Galatians it says, when the fullness of the time was come, God sent forth His Son. Well, that means that it took 4,000 years for God to get all of the details in order in the progress of His entire plan to make it possible and suitable for Christ to come when He came, 4,000 years after He had originally been declared to be coming. But all the way through the Old Testament, from Genesis on, you have new individual things about Messiah being put into the writings of the prophets. So that unless you were living in the days of Malachi, you wouldn't have had a complete Old Testament. You would have just had a partial Bible. And if you lived in the first century, before, I think the first letter that Paul wrote was in 50 A.D. And James was the earliest, I think, book of the New Testament. And he wrote that sometime probably in the 40s. So if you were a believer in the first half of the first century, you didn't have a Bible either. It wasn't until all of the gospel writers had written their records and all of the letters of Paul had been put together and Peter's letters and Jude and, you know. So from that point until the invention of the printing press, most Christians never had a Bible. We're blessed because we have, for the last 400 and some years, the printing press has made the Bible probably the most published book in the history of the world. And so we have the ability to look at words like those in the Old Testament and see how they develop in the New. So when we talk about a man who's made out of the dust of the ground, he has a spirit breathed into him, becomes a functional being, and then he is a living soul. Those are the seeds. Those are the seed concepts. They're way back here in Genesis 2. And so as we go through, we're going to see that there are some additional things said that help us to better understand body, soul, and spirit. And that's where we're headed this evening. We spent a couple of weeks working out of Genesis 3, the temptation, and it seems like that the tempter approached Eve and then Adam on the basis of the three things that were declared to be the creative work of man. In other words, the temptation had to do with his physical body, food. It had to do with his soul because she saw with her eyes that it was desirable, the fruit was. And then it had to do with her spirit because the issue of the spirit is the issue of being able to do things that your soul is revealing may be dangerous or appealing to you. So your spirit is attracted to what your soul says is good, and it considers dangerous things that the soul says are not good. So we're going to see how this works out. This evening we're going to start in Genesis 12. The first three verses of Genesis 12 are actually, and this is not an overstatement, but it's not an easy one to prove just in 20 minutes. But Genesis 12, 1-3 actually holds the history of mankind in its core. The whole history of mankind is in the core verses, or the core realities of Genesis 12, 1, 2, and 3. Because that passage is called the Abrahamic Covenant. And the Abrahamic Covenant consisted of three covenants. There was a land, a seed, and a great name. And in the Old Testament, the land covenant was the promise to Israel of a land. The seed covenant was given to David in 2 Samuel 7, where he was promised an eternal seed that would sit on his throne and rule the kingdom forever. And then in both Jeremiah and Ezekiel, there's the promise of a new covenant, not like the old covenant of the law. So those three covenants are right here in Genesis 12, 1-3. But they all three address the three aspects of man's makeup. And we're going to see that in the studies to come. But tonight I want us to think about some of the details of Genesis 12, 1-3. And I want us to think, first of all, about the background. Genesis chapters 1 through 11, which is just about this much of the Bible, covers 2,000 years of human history. I think there's 15 pages, 11 chapters. And the interesting thing about those 15 pages covering 2,000 years of human history, starting from the creation until Abraham, are covered in 15 pages, Genesis 1 through 11. There are two records of creation in three of those 15 pages. Chapters 1 and 2 of Genesis cover three pages. And it's a double presentation of creation. There's a creation presentation in Genesis 1, and then there's a restatement with a different theme and thesis in chapter 2, but it's still the creation. There is a record of man's entrance into sin's experience. Oh, and let me just say this. Those three pages of creation covers a 1 week of time. I'm a 7-day creationist. Covers 1 week of time. There's a record of the entrance of sin into man's experience, and it uses 1.5 pages of the remaining 12. And there's a record of the recurring thesis that this sin that was introduced in those 1.5 pages establishes sin as a death producer. Because in chapters 4 and 5, the chapter 5 is a genealogy, but you know what the last end of every statement is? And he died. So the death impact of sin, God had said in the day you eat thereof, dying you shall die. It was a Hebrew way of saying you're going to start dying and it's going to be a completed thing down the road. Genesis 5 is the record of the genealogies of Cain and Abel, basically, Cain and Seth, from Adam. And every time it says, and he died, except for Enoch. He was not, because the Lord took him. He didn't die. So there were 2.5 of the remaining 9.5 pages given over to this death theme. And then you have a record of the cataclysmic destruction of the first world by the flood, which quickly, over a period of 150 days, it snuffed out the life of every air-breathing thing on the planet except what was in the ark. So in less than, well, in a year and a half, that takes up 5 pages of the 15. It's all about the flood. And then there's a catalog of the nations as rebels against God made manifest at Babel, and that uses most of the remaining 2 pages. And the background of Abram uses a part of a page, and then starting in Genesis chapter 12, pow, you just slow. And here's Abram, and it takes us through his life. And there are chapter after chapter after chapter of Abraham, and then Isaac, and then Jacob, and this, you know. So my point in saying all this is Genesis 12, 1 to 3 is when the brakes got slammed on, and here's what God's going to say. This is what's important. The critical things. Now, the events of chapters 1 through 11 were all stage setting. They're all very important. The entrance of sin, the death by the flood, all of that. It's not unimportant. It's just that out of a 2,000-year period of history, there are just these few events that are taken up a few days or maybe a year and a half, and that's what was given over. So we're really, when we come to Genesis 12, we're starting on some really critical issues. And that's what brings us to the text itself, Genesis 12. Up until now, we weren't told a whole lot about the Lord saying anything to people except to Noah. He gave Noah instructions on building the ark and that kind of thing. But in chapter 12, verse 1, it says, "Now, Yahweh said to Abram," and this is what he said, "Go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to a land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth will be blessed." Now I want us to think about the 2 sets of 3. There's a command given that has 3 parts. One of them is go forth from your country, go forth from your relatives, go forth from your father's house. Those 3 things are what God required of Abram in this situation that he was setting up. He was going to give Abraham 3 promises, but he was going to require these 3 things. And it's interesting that the word translated country in verse 1 is the word Eretz, means land. Go forth from your land. Go forth from your earth, your field. And according to chapter 2, verse 9, it's the land, the Eretz, that provides the food for all the living creatures on the earth. So to tell him to leave his earth was in effect saying, "You're going to have to trust me to provide for you and your household and your flocks and your herds and all of that stuff, because you're not going to have a farm or a garden or anything. You're leaving your farm. You're leaving your land. You're leaving your garden. You're leaving your crops." Now, he didn't tell him not to take his flocks and herds, but, you know, he was free to do that. But there wasn't going to be any early development of any kind of agricultural thing for Abram. He was told by God, "You abandon that." And then he was told to abandon his relatives. And before I go into that one, I just want to point out that to be denied your land is to be denied your food, which has to do with your body. Okay? That should be fairly clear. The second is the demand that Abram abandon his relatives, which composed his blood kin tribe, the immediate relatives of his father and the genealogy of his father's family in that. According to chapter 4, verse 14, Cain's complaint, when God imposed his discipline on him, he said, "You've made me a vagabond and a wanderer, and now anybody that comes across me will kill me." And I believe that that's a direct reference to the fact that your relatives are your protection. In that day, in the nomadic type of setting and everything, If you had a large tribe that you belonged to, you were relatively safe, if I can use relatively both ways. Your relatives made you safe, and you were not quite totally safe, but you were relatively safe. Okay. So the issue there, leave your relatives, means that Abram's going to have to trust God to protect him. We're told later in the record that Abram developed some friendships with some allies in the land, so that when he went after the kings, even then he only had a little over 200 people that he could take and chase five kings down and deliver Lot from captivity and all that. But nonetheless, when he was told to leave his relatives, he didn't have that big of a family unit. He didn't have that big of a group. So the well-being was at risk if he did this. And God told him to do it. And so I believe that that's the issue of the soul. Because I really believe that our most fundamental issues concern our protection, our safety, our ability to not be hurt or killed. That's one of the most driving issues of existence. Somebody said just recently, well, we just have this will to live, and we just do whatever we have to do to stay alive. That's really true. Hebrews 2 tells us that men live in fear of death their whole lifetime. So because of the way this is working out, I really believe that what God is telling Abram to do when he has to leave his relatives is his soul now is going to have to rest in God's care, or he's not going to be cared for. And then you have to keep in mind that the Cain thing, where he says, I'm going to be a vagabond and wondering if somebody's going to kill me. Well, why is he worried about getting killed? Well, because he'd killed his brother. I'm going to use this illustration. Today I was watching an old Western on TV, and a mob of people wanted to hang a couple of guys that deserved to be hanged. But the sheriff in town was a stickler for obeying the law. He said, we're going to have a trial. No, we're going to hang him today. No, we're going to have a trial. So the people that wanted to hang him said, are you going to start shooting your friends to protect those two men? And that was an immediate attack on whether this sheriff would be willing to shoot his own friends. And I wanted to say, in fact, I did say to the television, turn that question back around on them. Am I your friend? Are you going to shoot me because I'm doing my job and upholding the law? But, of course, they didn't. They didn't hear me. They didn't hear me. But my point is, Cain lived and began a culture of violence and mayhem, and he was afraid of it because he had indulged himself in it for his own gain. Well, he knew other people were going to be kind of like that too. So that's why I say that leaving your relatives is a critical issue. And then the third thing is to leave your father's house. And in that culture, who your father was is what gave you your identity. You are so-and-so the son of. And you got your identity and your status in your tribe by your connection to your dad, your father. So that if your father was somebody significant, you were significant. If your father was a ne'er-do-well, you were considered a ne'er-do-well. You got your status, your sense of importance in the eyes of somebody because you belonged to your father. So to leave your father's house was, I think, the final thing. That's the Spirit's main issue. The spirit of man is most interested in not being insulted and being praised. Man's spirit longs to be recognized for his accomplishments. This was Cain's major flaw. I want to be accepted on the basis of the sacrifice for things I work for, to give to God a sacrifice. And God wouldn't accept it, and it made him just extremely angry. Well, that was the spirit of Cain. So, unless I'm completely missing the boat here, you have to abandon your physical sustenance for your body. You have to abandon your relatives, which is going to be your security for your soul. And you have to abandon your father's house. This is where you get your status. And I only have a minute or two left, but I just want to And we'll come back to this probably next week, but I want to make sure you understand that I'm not just pulling this out of my hat. He's not abandoning his land to go nowhere. He's going to go to a land that God will show him. So he has a command to leave a land and a promise of a land. So God's going to supply his physical need. He is going to have to leave his relatives. So the next thing God says, I'll make you a great nation. So you won't just have a tribe of people who care about you. You're going to be a great nation. And then the third thing, abandoning your father's house, which has to do with your status and significance, he says, I'll make your name great. So I really believe that the body, soul, and the spirit, and the land, and the seed, and the great name, and abandoning the land, and the relatives, and the father's house, they're all tied together. And when you back away from that and look at the history of humanity since those covenants were established, what you have is the land covenant, where almost all of the promises have to do with the well-being of your body. You obey me, you won't be sick, your wives will be productive for children, you're going to be healthy. It's all about the outer man, physical body. When Jesus came and the Jews crucified him, he made a whole new organism called the church. And in the church, it's not about your physical health. It's about your relational health. And we're members one of another. And so that's the issue of God shifting from the body to the relational issues of the soul. And then the great name that he promised Abram is going to finally find its fruition in the millennial kingdom. But the issue there is that he is giving us a status that is beyond our imagination. We have to leave our father's house, and what do we become? Children of God Almighty himself. You can't get a greater status than that. So I really do think that even historically, we have the age of the law where the land is the issue. We have the age of the church where the soul is the issue. And we have a millennial kingdom where the spirit's the issue.